Yo, what's up, guys? New podcast with Jean Hébert. He runs the Hébert Lab at Albert Einstein's College of Medicine. He focuses on replacing aging in the brain. And what he means by replacing aging is that as you age, your brain shrinks, it atrophies, and it declines in volume over time. And so, what he is working on doing is that you can start to silence certain parts of your brain, and then the memories and the functions within that part of the brain will move to another part of the brain from the silence part, and then you undergo surgery and you actually take out the silenced tissue and replace it with young tissue. And so this essentially means that over time, if you do this surgery like over 20 years a few times, you can replace your entire brain. That is their goal. And so this is what he means by replacing aging, because if you start at 70, you'll be 90 years old and then you'll have the brain of a 20-year-old. Which is crazy. This was incredible. This was an awesome conversation. Let's get into it.
Now is the time to take risk.
I will start recording. Okay, so we have Jean Hebert. Is that how you say your name?
Yeah, it's close enough. Yeah.
Okay, it's close enough. Okay, so Jean Hebert, you're a researcher at the Albert Einstein Institute of Medicine, and you are looking at replacing brain tissue as we age. This is just super fascinating because, obviously I want to live beyond 100 years and our brain is essential for that. So I don't know if you want to give a bit more on your background or if you want to dive into what happens to our brains as we age, just go for it.
I mean, I can give you a minute on my background. I'm basically trained as a developmental geneticist and then focused on development of the brain and sort of the cell biology and genetics that underlie brain development.
Okay, so your research focuses on what happens to our brain as we age and how we can stop that. What exactly happens to our brain as we age that you're focused on?
Yeah. So I'm happy with what the previous work that was done to characterize what happens to our brain when we age. So we don't actually study that ourselves because I think to some extent we know enough of what happens to our brain, and there's very little we can do about it except remove all the damage at once by tissue replacement. So I'll elaborate on that, but essentially what happens to our brain when we age, if it's not already obvious from the cognitive decline that happens to our older relatives progressively, is, especially when they get into their 90s, if they're lucky enough to make it that far, or even their early hundreds, as sharp as you might say they are, they're just not operating at the level of a young brain, right? So what happens is the substrate just degrades. So our brains are comprised of billions of neurons connected to each other. Other cell types are also very important for the function of the brain. There's a lot of support cell types. There's vascular cells, and there's this group of cells called glia that keep all our neurons healthy. Our neurons are nerve cells, keep our neurons healthy and happy and functioning. All those decrease with age. And the reason why they stop functioning normally is largely because of macromolecular damage. So we're made of mostly a protein. Much of that protein is not inside of our cells, but outside of the cells, like collagen, or
Elastin.
elastin is another big component. So there's a lot of these proteins. So we're made of proteins, we're made of carbohydrates, we're made of fats, and we're made of nucleic acids, mainly DNA, right? Well, RNA as well. So all of those accumulate forms of damage that in some cases are irreversible because there's a loss of information content, but in many cases irreversible just because, it just becomes a horrible mess. The damage that occurs is stochastic. So proteins will glob together, they'll break apart, they'll form, they'll adopt like new conformations that are not reversible with enzymes or degradable. So it becomes a horrible mess over time, even though we're really well built. I mean, we last, decades and decades functioning like this. But eventually, this damage that accumulates throughout our lives becomes overwhelming to our system. It's not just the brain, but every part of the body. And then there's a sharp decline. right? Even though we might appear fairly healthy and functioning normally, and again, if we're lucky into our 80s, 90s, 100s, we reach a wall at some point where there's just nothing that can overcome the level of damage in our brains and bodies.
So I actually kind of had a question about that, because what you were saying is like when we age, our brain volume kind of decreases, but because you still have neuroplasticity, the elderly brain can kind of still be neuroplastic and like still remember stuff and do stuff. What kind of happens when there's that sharp decline in function? What exactly is happening there?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of our systems in our body compensate really well for damage, that the slow damage that accumulates with age, including the brain. So the brain in particular is well adapted to compensate. It's a very plastic organ in terms of serving our purposes. So our brain evolved not to be accurate recording devices, which we like to think of them as accurate recording.
Definitely not.
I mean, in a way, it's good because we can learn new things all the time, but we're also forgetting things all the time. And so it's very plastic in the sense that it's functional. It serves our purposes. And so if there is damage to our brain over time, like age-related damage, it will compensate. So we'll start using other parts of the brain for those functions. And that's what happens in elderly people. If you look at the functioning brain of a younger adult, everything is pretty compartmentalized, much more compartmentalized than in an old person. Old person has to use more and more of their brain for routine function just to manage in their environment, right? So if you look by functional MRI at their brains, they're using wider and wider areas just to do what they need to do during the day. And that's plasticity. Because that's what that person needs. That's what the brain is going to be devoted to. You know, so plasticity is not an instant process, or it's progressive. So as you keep using things, you know, space in your brain gets allocated more and more for that purpose. And that concept of plasticity, I mean, maybe we'll come back to it, but it's very important to our approach of replacing tissue progressively over time. Mm-hmm.
So this is where you come in. So how do you start replacing this tissue?
Yeah, so it's not easy. I'll start off by saying that. Again, because the brain is very complicated, made of many different types of nerve cells and many different types of support cells, that they all have to be there for the brain to function normally. They all have to be replaced. And they're also organized in a particular structure. So they're not just randomly, you know, put together. So in the part of our brain that we use for our highest cognitive functions, that's the neocortex, it's organized in layers. And so we have to, if we're going to, you know, replace tissue, we have to build it exactly how it is normally formed for it to function. And so those are the challenges, some of the challenges that we're facing in doing this is reassembling sort of the stem cells for all the different cell types in such a way that as they mature and differentiate and form tissue, that tissue now has the right ratio of the mature cell types in the right positions, and so hopefully functioning normally.
So kind of like when a part of the brain starts to atrophy, what you do is you kind of silence that part, and then over time, the neuroplasticity, like whatever was contained in that part of the neocortex, moves to another part of the brain. And then you take out the part that you silence and replace it with this engineered tissue. So how, like, it sounds like you're focused on engineering this tissue. What kind of goes into, like, how do you get this tissue?
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe we'll step back a little. So yes, you're right. The brain does shrink as we get old to some extent. And that in itself allows space to introduce new tissue. So that would be the first step in reversing, you know, age-related brain damage, is to just add tissue without removing it. But eventually, you know, because the blood vessels are getting really stiff and you're at increased risk of strokes and aneurysm with time, you're going to want to replace all the old tissue as well, not just add new tissue. And in the tissue, you'll have new vasculature, new nerve cells, and all the support cells you need. And you want to be able to remove the old tissue without losing the function that it encodes. So that has to be done very progressively over the course of, you know, for something like language, if you wanted to replace like the language center in your brain without losing the ability to speak at any time, so without interrupting your ability to speak, it would take at least 3 years, right, for that function to move to a new substrate.
Wow.
So you would have to, so part of the approach ultimately to defeat aging is to silence each area of the brain, not at the same time, but, you know, in like multiple steps progressively. So you would, we have technologies where we could silence the neuronal activity within a pinpoint area and then expand it out to include like all the language center. And as we're doing that, we previously introduced new tissue close by, and some of the functions, if we keep talking every day, will naturally, because of how the brain works, move to that new substrate as well as neighboring substrates. And then once that tissue has been completely silenced, it's no longer useful. We're not using it for any cognitive function. We can remove it and use that space for new tissue as well.
Okay. How do you, if it takes 3 years to slowly expand the silencing, like, do you just have, I don't know, five surgeries a year and like silence this, or how do you silence this over time?
Yeah. So, you know, again, because of the time and wanting to do it progressively, and, you know, if you do it too fast, you'll revert to like an infant-like state with this, putting in the immature tissue. And we don't want that.
Yeah.
The point is to preserve who we are, to live longer, right, with all our memories and functions. And so to do that, you probably need, yeah, like a half dozen surgeries over the course of 20 to 30 years.
Wow.
So you'd want to start, you know, in your 70s or 80s at the latest, and then over the course.
And like some of those surgeries are for silencing, and then some of those are for like adding and removing new tissue.
Yeah. But, you know, for each step, you can do them coincidentally, right? You can do them at the same time.
Oh, okay.
And then wait 3 years and then do it again. Yeah. So, you know, this is what a lot of people don't like about this approach, is that it involves brain surgery, and Nobody wants brain surgery, right? But it really is, I think, the only way to truly reverse age-related damage, and that would allow us to escape aging. Mm-hmm. It combined with replacements for the rest of the body, which I think are moving along nicely. I mean, there's already lab-grown organs used in clinics, you know, so that's moving along. So if we can get the brain to be progressively replaced in combination with body part replacements, then whether they're synthetic or biologic, then we will truly be able to reverse aging, not just slow down or live healthier lives and still hit this wall, you know, 100, somewhere between 100 and 120.
So I'm sure that like you've looked at non-surgical methods. So can you explain why non-surgical methods, like, I don't know, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, like a pill that would start regenerating new brain tissue or use the stem cells in your brain or something. Why doesn't that work?
Yeah. So there are a lot of approaches, you know, cellular reprogramming is a very popular one now. Previous to that, senolytics, you know, getting rid of old cells, that's still very popular. Previous to that was, you know, telomeres or, you know, mitochondria. I mean, there's example after example of these things. But the problem is everything is accumulating damage. So you can't target just one thing and expect to stop aging. In fact, all it takes is one of those things to keep aging. Even if you fixed all the rest, if you just have one of those things that are still going bad, you know, you're still going to have a very limited lifespan. And that's shown in humans with mutations for like DNA repair genes, for example. That's all it takes. One thing to go bad, and then you have accelerating. So even if everything else is working fine.
So it's not possible to like do it non-surgically, like have a pill that targets a certain area of the brain or something that targets a certain area of the brain, and then kills it and then starts regenerating it somehow. That's just not.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's technically not possible. Again, the forms of damage that accumulate too are very complex. There's like many, many documented forms of this, what I call macromolecular damage, right? The damage that occurs to proteins. And these proteins no longer turn over and can't turn over, so you can't replace them. And so you'd be looking at, you know, combinations of dozens or 100 different drugs that would need to go in and fix each of those forms of damage without, you know, hurting normal proteins.
Yeah.
These drugs
at a specific location in the brain. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's just not possible in 2020, 2021. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, surgery is the, you know, the only way. And you don't, there's very limited stem cells in the adult brain. It's actually controversial whether they still exist in adult humans and for how long. But even if they do, they're in very small, restricted locations of the brain. So,
really?
Yeah, yeah. So the ones that everyone talks about all the time are like, oh, you know, yeah, there's stem cells in the brain throughout our lives. Yeah, but they're really not that useful. They give rise to very specific types of nerve cells or neurons in very specific locations.
What are the locations? Because I've always heard like the reason that I think that is because, oh, you go for a run or you work out and then you have neurogenesis is the,
exactly,
is the prime word. And then everyone's like, oh, your brain is regenerating. But
yeah,
it's only regenerating where?
Yeah, it's only in a part of the brain called the hippocampus. It's a very important part of the brain. It's involved in forming new memories, but it has other functions. But it's a very small part of the brain relative to like the neocortex. Neocortex is the outer folded tissue. When you imagine a human brain and you see all those folds, it looks like noodles, that's the neocortex, right? You don't see much of anything else. But in there are other parts of the brain. One of them is the hippocampus. Part of the hippocampus, like a third of it, is called the dentate gyrus. And a small layer of cells within that small part of the small part of the brain are neural stem cells. At least,
no way.
At least in some mammals. Again, controversial whether they're still they're in humans. But yeah, so it's really not, I mean, it's exercise is healthy, right?
So that's just a pop science thing that went way too far.
It's way inflated. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do those stem cells transfer to other areas of the brain, or they just can't extend?
Yeah, so those experiments have been done in mammals where they clearly exist in adults, and transplanting them to other parts of the brain. The problem is they still give rise to the cell types that they're supposed to for the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus. They're not going to give rise to neocortical cells.
So even though it's stem cells, it's programmed for hippocampus.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah, so I see. They're not useful. So then you can talk about, well, we actually thought about this for a while. Well, what if we can like somehow get them to migrate to the neocortex and then become something else? It just gets so difficult to do that compared to just putting in new neocortical cells there to start with, right? You still have to do surgeries to manipulate these. So why not just put the cells you want in the right place and let them do what they do?
To me, manipulating cells to become something else sounds a lot like Michael Levin's research. Have you looked into his stuff with the xenobots and the bioelectricity?
Yeah. I'm aware of it. That sounds very cool. And I think it's super important, like for other parts of the body. I don't see how it will apply to the brain. The reason I say that is other parts of the body can be replaced as whole organs, right? And that's sort of what he's showing, is that you can use this bioelectricity for morphogenesis, right? To shape organs and tissues as they're growing. So I think that's could be hugely important. We haven't seen the results yet, but it could be hugely important for engineering or optimizing lab-grown organs, which again are already being developed. Every organ in the body is in preclinical trials. So I'm optimistic about the body, but for the brain, again, yeah, you can't replace the whole brain, right? That's who you are. So you can only do it progressively. And you can only do it you can't even build the tissue and let it mature out of the brain and then put it in, because it won't connect anymore. right? It has to be this very immature tissue that is still sending out processes and making connections to the rest of the brain in order to work. So we have to actually rebuild the tissue in the brain itself. And so that gets a little trickier, and we can't get pieces that are too big. So we don't really need this bioelectricity, but it sounds like it could be very useful for the rest of the body. And I really look forward to hearing more about that.
I mean, I'm sure you've looked at all the approaches. So it seems like the focus then is building this extracellular matrix, like outside of the brain, and then implanting it. How do you go about growing that?
Yeah. And so it's the whole tissue, right? So tissues in our brain, or any part of our body, are composed of cells and then this extracellular matrix I mentioned, which is surrounds the cells. This extracellular matrix is hugely important. The cells that are there are completely dependent on that extracellular matrix for their function and their survival and communicating with other cells. So it's really important. And it's actually where most of the age-related damage accumulates, because there's very little turnover of that extracellular matrix with time. And so we really need to replace that. And all these other approaches, like cellular reprogramming, senolytics, and all that, they basically ignore the extracellular matrix, which is a big problem with these approaches. That's why I think tissue organ and tissue replacement is ultimately how we're going to defeat. So yeah, so we build this in culture. We give ourselves a bit of a head start, since that's the question you're asking, is how do we build this extracellular matrix and the cells. So we to structure it. And again, we build it in the brain. So we create a lesion in the brain, and then we fill it with a tissue that's organized. So it's like it's like bioprinting, except we kind of do it by hand now. I hope we have robots that can do this more efficiently than we can.
Yeah.
But we put in both the cells and the extracellular matrix. So both are damage-free, you know, pristine new tissue that's immature. And then, you know, very immediately afterwards, you know, the cells themselves are also producing their own components that they add to this extracellular matrix so that it's more functional.
So one of the biggest problems or that I know of with bioprinting is like the vascularization. Yep. And often like the scaffold doesn't support itself. How are you guys kind of dealing with that?
Yeah. So in a way we're lucky. The brain is more like the skin than it is like the liver. It's actually somewhat of a flat tissue, or a thin tissue, I should say, that's all folded up. So again, like the neocortex, it's not that thick. It's just that it's all folded up. So it's maybe harder to access, but you can replace like thin layers of it. And so you can quickly get vascularization, right? So for the solid organs, the problem with not getting good vascularization is you can't scale up the size of those organs enough to, you know, get normal size organs. Although again, there, I think that's going to be achievable before too long. But the brain, where, you know, we have less of that problem because we can use thin or narrow tissue replacements that get fairly quickly vascularized. So we add blood vessel cells to our tissues that form vessels and fuse with the host vasculature fast enough that we don't really lose any tissue that way.
What kind of size of tissue are we talking about? Like, is it a centimeter cubed or?
Yeah, it's a centimeter cubed, although we're thinking of going a little longer. So we haven't done a centimeter cube yet. What we've done in mice is like 2 millimeters.
Okay.
So it's substantially smaller, but we can get 2 millimeter, like longer strips that we put in, right? So they're no further away from the host, so that as long as they form their vessels like they do normally and fuse with the host vasculature, it won't take any more time for that full tissue to be vascularized.
So the time that it takes to integrate with the brain is not like scale. It doesn't scale with the size that you're replacing.
No. And in this case, no, because the distance of any graft cell to the host does not increase if we're using, sort of one strip. And so, yeah, I think that's makes it a little easier for us why we do it in vivo, in the brain, we do these replacements so that we get quick vascularization. So the vasculature forms very, very quickly, but the neurons take a long time to integrate into the brain. Human neurons take, a couple of years to mature. And so with our grafts, that's why it also takes a long time for replacement. It's not just the silencing process that has to be slow. It's also the integration of the new tissue that, and the differentiation and integration of that tissue takes like at least 2 years as well, or about 2 years.
So the tissue that you're adding, does it have, it has like young immature neurons in it, right? And then they have to just grow?
Yeah. They're even the stage that we're looking at reconstructing, this very immature stage, is sort of like the halfway through brain development in humans. So they're still young enough that their projections are being made and refined and becoming functional, but not so young that, we're asking, just one population of stem cells to, here, we're putting you in the adult now form a normal brain tissue. I think that's too much to ask.
Okay.
For several technical reasons, I don't think that would succeed. So we're kind of like taking an immature stage, and in that stage, there's young immature neurons, and there's still some stem or progenitor cells that are generating even new neurons. So there's going to be a little bit of tissue growth as well as differentiation after we do the graft.
Okay, so it'll kind of expand over time as well.
It'll expand a little bit, yeah.
Okay, and so you were saying like the if your brain atrophies and say like it's at the language center or wherever you have certain types of words, those words migrate over time to a new area as like that initial area atrophies. Yeah. When you replace that area, do those words like move back to the original location, or do they kind of stay in their place and then something else takes over the new location area?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's very plastic. They can move back. I mean, this has been shown in humans. So it's not actually words, right? It's a little more complicated. It's our words are sort of connected to a lot of concepts in our brains that, we think in terms of language, right? So there's a lot of connectivity that goes there, but that's why it's so impressive that the language center itself can move over time. But so what was I saying? Yeah.
Does that function kind of go back to the original area, or does it stay in the new area and then something else takes over there?
It could potentially. I mean, that hasn't been shown in humans, but there are well-documented cases in humans where the language center has moved to a new location in adults of advanced age who have had the bad luck of having a benign glioma grow in the language center and slowly destroy, in a way having the good fortune that it's a benign glioma and not like a glioblastoma that kills you in a few months, right? So there are benign forms of gliomas that are operable. So, patients don't even know that their original language center has been destroyed because during the years that it's taken for that tumor to grow, they've had no symptoms. They've continued to speak normally. Everybody who knows them hasn't noticed anything different. They haven't. Mm. Then they go in and take out the tumor with surrounding tissue for good measure. And now you have a big hole there. And once the inflammation goes down, they still speak normally, right? And so they look at where the language center is. And they've had recurrences in some of these patients of tumors. So they had to go in again years later. And then they say, okay, so now where's the language center? And it's moved again. It's possible that it would move back to the younger tissue. Again, it's all use dependent. Mm-hmm. So the plasticity takes time. So if you compare that to people who have strokes that also affect the language center with about the same amount of damage, same age individuals, language centers, you basically can't speak anymore. Language is gone, right? Because there's no time for plasticity to occur. So that's really important, is that these things occur progressively over time, and we need to have that happen, our replacement to happen progressively over time. The other thing is it's use dependent. So even in these benign gliomas, if an individual stopped using language, I don't know if how that's possible, because we think in terms of language, but let's say, you know,
off grid.
Stop using words and stop talking. Then the function won't move to a new location as it's being destroyed. So it's very use dependent. Our brains have evolved to serve us, you know, to be useful to us to survive in the environment. So if we keep using that function, then it will move to a new substrate.
So one of your first clinical trials that you want to do is with stroke victims, right? Yeah. And so when they have a stroke, like that function just goes away because it didn't have time to migrate. What's the process for regaining those functions using this technique?
Yeah. So the idea is a little bit different than reversing aging, because reversing aging, again, has the damage or the silencing has to be progressive. And then you have to give time for the new tissue to incorporate with the goal of not interrupting any function or self identity. With stroke, it's too late, right? You've lost that tissue. You're not going to get those same memories or functions back by putting in new tissue automatically.
Mm-hmm.
But what you will do end up doing it is that you're providing now this infant-like substrate that can very easily learn things, right? It's like a one-year-old brain, or you know, the brain of a six-month-old. It's just very easy to absorb new functions and learn things. And so that's the idea. It's going to make it a lot easier to recover for stroke victims, to recover the functions that they've lost, whether it's language or motor function in the contralateral side of the body. And it's also, you know, importantly to us, going to be a proof of concept that our tissue works.
Mm-hmm. Right?
In humans. So we have
so it's kind of like an easier, like you can pretty easily find stroke victims and then pretty easily like know what happened and what went wrong. And so the data is easier to show that like it actually works than like just normal aging.
Yeah. So either stroke victims or anybody with a localized traumatic injury, like a penetrating wound, for example. Those will be our first, you know, clinical applications, just to show that whereas a person who doesn't get the treatment doesn't improve much. I mean, there's always a little compensation because, again, the brain is plastic, but with the tissue that they recover much better and more quickly.
I was going to make a joke about the hippocampus stem cells that they can recover there, but maybe nowhere else.
Yeah.
So what are you working on these days, like near term?
Yeah, well, we're trying to accelerate this work. So I'm spending a lot of my time sort of fundraising, either in the private sector, mostly in the private sector these days. But from a scientific point of view, what we're working on are our three main goals. One is, as we've been talking about, to engineer this tissue, which requires, you know, several stem cell biologists, because there are many cell types involved, and it requires a certain expertise to derive these immature stem cells for all these different types of cells.
What can I ask just why that's like what the technical difficulties are there to derive those stem cells?
Sure. I mean, it's, I just brought on somebody on our team who's a real expert at this. And it's actually required more expertise than I even realized. But basically what we're doing, you can start with completely undifferentiated cells called embryonic stem cells. So we have these human embryonic stem cells, and they have the potential to give rise to every cell type in the body. And if you differentiate them in the dish, they try to do this, but it's like terribly disorganized. So what we do is try to guide them towards a particular cell type that we want and avoid them becoming all the other cell types. So that requires like adding a lot of signals or factors to them so they go stepwise down this pathway to becoming the cell, even the stem cell type that we want.
So
it's a lot of work.
Do you have to say you're replacing, you know, in location A versus location B, you kind of have to know, like, we want these cell types for location A and these cell types for location B?
Yeah, to a large extent, that's what it is. For the part of the brain that we're tackling first, the neocortex, again, it's more the layers. The cell types, if you flatten out our neocortex into a sheet, the cell types are pretty, they're not equal over all areas, but they're pretty much the same in each layer. But between layers, they're quite different.
Okay. So it's like cell type A, cell type B, like as you layer down.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's more like that.
So then you can kind of like, I'm just thinking about scaling this up. Like you can kind of have maybe five parallel processes, each making like A, B, C, D, E. And then you can like implant those in patients as needed. So it's not like, it doesn't have to be like personalized to the person. It just has to be the right cell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
There's several reasons why you want to personalize it though. Definitely you have to adjust it to the area of damage for something like stroke but I think it's probably ultimately going to be best to use patient-derived stem cells. So you may be aware, right, that you can take skin cells and de-differentiate them all the way back to this very immature embryonic stem cell-like stem cell. And from that, you can generate all cell types of the body. So that's a well-established procedure. It's kind of lengthy and more expensive. But in the end, it gives you cells that are derived from you. So there's no rejection. And also, for the brain, it's still not clear, this big nature versus nurture question, like how much of what gives you your personality and who you are encoded in your genes versus acquired during development. Like clearly both play a role. But if you're using somebody else's cells, like it's, it might change who you are to some extent. So it might be better to use patient-derived cells. If it's local damage, it probably doesn't make too much of a difference. But if you're going to
replace your entire brain.
Exactly. Yeah, I think I'd prefer it be my cells.
Because are there still epigenetic markers even as you revert them skin cells back to stem cells?
So when you take skin cells, so you basically use transcription factors that change the whole sort of expression landscape on that cell. With that comes changes in the epigenetics. And so it works. It works well enough that you can use iPS cells and clone, an animal with it. Mm-hmm. So meaning that those cells can now form every cell type in the body. Right? Mm-hmm. So that works well enough, but this is not what I've looked at very closely, but there may still be traces of skin cell epigenetic markers in these very undifferentiated cells, right? So ideally, you'd want it to be completely devoid of any trace of the previous cell. And, I'm not sure to what extent that's 100% true yet, but it seems to work well enough that you can generate like a whole animal from cells. So it's still good enough, I think.
Yeah. How do you generate the cells for the mice studies that you're running? Do you take it from their cells and then implant it to the mice? And then, this is kind of a weird question, but like, have you taken cells from another mice and replaced the brain of another mice, like a separate mice, and seen if their behavior changes or something?
Yeah, so we've done a little bit of that. We have three sources of cell types that we transplant in mice for, to test our tissue. One is fetal mouse brain cells that we take from fetal mice and dissociate and transplant into adult mice to try to fix damage that we created on purpose, but very small areas of damage. And then we also use human cells that we get from, like I was describing, these human embryonic stem cells, which are readily available. So we differentiate different cell types from those and reassemble them in the adult mouse brain. These mice are highly immune compromised, so they don't reject the cells. And we also use, when we can get some, human fetal brain tissue, because that is very valuable to us as a tissue that is what we aspire to achieving with our engineering, because it has all the developing cell types arranged in the right way, you know, with the right interactions between them. And so ideally, that's what we're trying to engineer. So once in a while, it helps to compare what we have to the real thing.
Mm-hmm. So you compare that to like the real thing compared to your derivation from the skin cells that you're transforming into stem cells into these cells.
Yeah. So we start from the stem cells. We don't have to take it from the skin.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. And you know, when we do mouse to mouse transplants, or, you know, we don't take it from the mouse. Like we can use another mouse's cells. It's fine. We don't seem to get much rejection.
Okay. So, cause I guess they're immune compromised.
Yeah. Well, definitely when we put the human cells in the mice, we use mice that are immune compromised, but when we take the cells from one mouse, put it into another, we were worried about rejection. But because it's the brain, it's sort of inaccessible to much of the immune system. And so it works remarkably well without immune compromising. So we usually don't immune compromise in that case, and that works fine.
Okay, nice. I don't know. Well, like what were some of the studies that kind of boosted your confidence or got you interested in this? Or, I mean, those are two kind of separate questions.
Yeah, I mean, the two main points that to me said this is doable, as well as being the only way to really beat aging, is that one is this plasticity, these cases in humans that show that functions as complicated as language can move seamlessly from one part of the brain to another. So that means that progressive replacement should be possible. The other reason why is all these studies, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, showing that if you put in these immature brain precursors or immature brain stem cells, they give rise to nerve cells or neurons that do remarkably well in terms of connecting to the rest of the brain. They respond to sensory input. If you put them in the visual cortex and excite like a mouse's eyes, they'll respond just like neighboring cells. You can put them in a motor cortex and excite them and they'll cause movement. So they're connecting relatively normally. So those two things, the plastic nature of the neocortex in particular, but the brain in general, combined with the ability of these immature precursors to form functional cells, together, to me, I said that, yeah, it's not going to be easy, but we can do this. And it's not going to be easy because we need to reassemble all the cells in the right structure. But that's just a technical issue that we should be able to overcome.
Yeah, and that's actually a great point, because I kind of derailed us while I was asking you about what you're working on near term after the first one. So what are the other two things that you're working on near term?
I was just thinking of that too. It's like, I never heard that. The other two things are to look at the extent of projections in larger brains. So all our studies so far have been in mice. And before we're allowed to do this in humans, we have to show that the cells, that the new neurons that are derived from our grafts can connect over longer distances. Because in a mouse, we see that our cells connect all the way to the spinal cord. Fantastic. But that's like only a centimeter in distance, right? It's not that far. So we have to show that this can also work in larger brains, because in a human, we're now talking like at least a foot.
Is there like an intermediate brain that you're using? Are you going to do this on monkeys or?
Yeah, exactly. We kind of have to use monkeys, unfortunately, which I'm not happy about. But again, they won't let us do this in people until we show it in monkeys. So, and the other one is a much more functional.
How far are you on the monkeys? Like, have you done anything there?
We've done not with ours, but just with what other people are working on. We've done some preliminary tests in terms of working out the surgical procedure. So we also have different components to this experiment. We need to know when our tissue is differentiated well enough that it can be used for a task appropriate for the location in the brain where we put the graph. And for that, we need to monitor the graph maturation with an electrode. So we're testing these things in mice first. And we also have this neat trick where we can silence specifically the graph tissue transiently. And this is the most important part of the experiment, because that will allow us to prove that it's the electrophysiological activity of the graph that's underlying the acquired function. Because when we silence the graph and the animal is no longer able to perform the task, and then we reactivate the graph and it's able to perform the task again, that'll be pretty clear that it's the activity of those.
Yeah. So like that tissue still functions, but you kind of just silence the electrical activity in there?
Yeah, exactly. Just the electrical activity.
How do you do that?
Metabolically happy and alive and everything. It just can't fire action potentials.
How does that technically work? Like, how do you silence that?
There's this really nice tools that have been developed, again, fairly recently in neuroscience, that where you have these channels that you can express in neurons. And you can either shine light on those channels to cause the neuron to stay in an inactivatable state, or to activate it. So different channels do different things. And this is called optogenetics, because the channels are genetically encoded or genetically expressed in the neurons. And then you can use light to activate them or inhibit those neurons from firing. And you can do the same instead of with light, with small chemical inducers, and that's called chemogenetics. And it's basically the same idea, where you can control the activity of the neurons that way. And that's what we're looking at doing here.
And so are you fairly confident that the tissue replacements will like expand on the larger brain size, like in the monkeys?
Well, yeah, I mean, in this case, we're removing a piece of tissue and replacing it, right? So, and we're not doing the progressive silencing. Okay. So we're doing just a lesion. It's a very small lesion. We're removing 2 millimeters of the neocortex, but that's enough to, you know, that's the part of the motor cortex that controls like a digit, one finger or something. Mm-hmm. And so the monkey won't be able to use that finger. For a while, until our graph differentiates.
Until you grease him with the use of...
So it's pretty minor. It's not like a huge surgical procedure either. Mm-hmm. You know, luckily, the neocortex is all the surface of the brain, so it's very accessible as well. And yeah, I mean, I still don't like the idea of using monkeys, but again, they won't live in humans yet.
Yeah. And what? So I derailed us again, but I like asking follow-up questions. What's the third part that you're working on?
Oh, that is the third part. It's a functional test. Yeah. So one is just the sort of the anatomical connectivity of our neurons. Can they project far enough into the right targets in a large brain, just like they can in a small brain? Mm-hmm. And so that's one. And then the other one is the functional replacement. We're designing them. They're quite different in the actual details of how we're doing those experiments. So I think of them as separate, but they're two very important proofs of concept that this will work in the human brain.
Okay. And then, so like long-term, the vision here is that as you age, what age would you start doing this? Like around 70 years old or so?
Yeah.
And then, so as you age around 70 years, maybe 60 years old, you start slowly replacing parts of your brain every few years. And then after maybe 20 years of doing this, 15 years of doing this, then you have a new brain that's maybe like 20 years old. And then you have another 70 years. That's kind of like.
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of difficult. You would have to do this in combination with replacing, you know, organs in your body, and the order in which you do that might depend on your predispositions to disease. If you have heart disease in your family, you might want to go for the heart first.
Yeah.
Replace that. Or, you know, if you have diabetes, you go for pancreas or kidney disease. But in any case, yeah, you'd want to, within also a fairly short amount of time, you know, rejuvenate your body by replacing especially essential organs with new young ones. That will help recover from the surgery as well, because although old people undergo, you know, they do very well in surgery. It's just a recovery process that they have trouble with and sometimes aren't able to recover. Like a lot of old people die from a broken hip, right? They just fall away their hip. It's not that the incident itself killed them. It's just they can't recover from it.
Well, what slows the recovery here?
Old tissue.
So if they had a new hip, a new bone, then it would recover faster.
Yeah. Except the surgical procedure for putting that in also causes, you know, a lot of wounds and stuff. So they have to recover from that.
So maybe put new skin on first and then replace your bone.
You don't want to wait till you're 90 to start doing this. Maybe in your 70s.
So like Alzheimer's is a pretty big problem for old people. Does this kind of help with Alzheimer's? How does it relate there?
Yeah, it could help for any type of dementia, including these accelerating dementias like Alzheimer's or frontotemporal dementia, because again, you're putting in new tissue. And in most cases, sometimes there's genetic predispositions for that disease that are known. So you could correct the cells before putting them in so that they'll function better. Over time, you know, for Alzheimer's, again, there is familial Alzheimer's, and that people develop dementia fairly early in life. But for most people, it's just predispositions. But still, you could probably correct those as well.
Tissue. I had a question and I forgot the question.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep up. You got a lot of good questions.
Dang it. I thought about it and then I was like, oh, that's a really good question. Then my brain kind of.
Talking about Alzheimer's.
Yeah. I don't know. I completely forgot it. Oh, yeah. Okay. What about, so we're focused on the neocortex. There's like deeper layers to the brain as well. How do those function as we age? And can we also start replacing those? I know that's like deeper in the brain and more difficult, but what's the roadmap there?
Yeah, it's deeper in the brain and more difficult, but you know, neurosurgeons access them routinely anyway. I mean, that's what they do. So it's not like they're not reachable. They are reachable, and they would need to be replaced, you know, to get rejuvenation of the brain, because they also age. And if they fail, you know, you will not be able to function optimally. They're very important to neurofunction. And, you know, we're focusing on the neocortex now, and our discussion is focused largely on the neocortex. But if you're going to be tackling aging, you're going to want to replace strategically parts of the brain that are most wired up together. So motor cortex with like intermediate targets leading to the spinal, visual cortex with, you know, the visual part of the midbrain and maybe even the optic nerve, you know, so that they wire together and function normally. So yeah, this is, you can't ignore all the other parts of the brain or else, things won't work properly.
So I guess like one of the most important things right now is fundraising. So if anybody's listening, like give them the pitch, I guess, or what do you need? What kind of money do you need, or roadmaps, or?
Yeah, I mean, I just would like to see more money going into this. Right now, there's a fair amount of investment in biotech and even in the longevity space within biotech. They're big investments. At best, they're going to lead to treatments that keep us healthier as we nevertheless age. And I know some people out there are really interested in not just doing that, but, you know, living longer and having their loved ones live longer. I mean, my dad, he's like first in line, like, please, you know, find a way to reverse what's going on with me.
And I bet he's asking you all the time, like, when is this going to be available?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm like, full, you know, hang tight. I don't know if, you know, we're going to have it in time. But yeah, so if we really want to be able to reverse aging, then it comes down to, I think, tissue replacement. And that's a big project. It's, you know, we can't do it alone. We're going to need like a lot of help from people for different parts of the brain, like you mentioned, and also different parts of the body, right? So there's a fair amount of money going into regenerative medicine now and lab-grown organs and tissue engineering. But, you know, I think funding there too is still the limitation. And in any case, this needs to grow for the brain. There are very few labs that are thinking about tissue replacements for the brain. And, you know, that's because it's very hard to get funding from federal sources. So the private sector, if they want to defeat aging, then they, you know, maybe they should
start
on this direction.
I think the timeline is like 5 years for stroke victims and then another 5 years for maybe dementia, atrophy, kind of aging. How could you monetize this in the meantime? Like, because it's hard to fund that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so there are things that can be done in the meantime to make this, to provide commercial incentive to investors. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea. So one of them is, and it wouldn't require FDA approval or anything, is that once you have engineered this tissue, even though it's in a mouse, it's a human tissue, you know, with you know, all composed of all the different human cell types and to some level functioning in the mouse. So that should be very valuable to a lot of companies, a lot of big pharma companies that are developing drug to treat any type of brain disorder, even psychiatric brain disorders, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, they spend billions of dollars going to clinical trials based on how these drugs affect mouse brains, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, the large majority of them fail. And so they've wasted so much money. And so for a fraction of that cost, they could test it on human tissue, human brain tissue, and see how that works.
There's been a lot of like tissue on a chip kind of startups.
Yeah. And they're nicely complementary to like mice, but they're still not functional. Like they have like two-dimensional flat cells and expect that to be, you know, representative of tissue function. So it's the same idea, though. At least it's human. So mm-hmm. at least in that sense, it's a little bit closer to what might happen in humans, but it's still a far cry from like a functional tissue. So I think if we can get our tissue to develop relatively normally, you know, we'll be head and shoulders above these tissues.
That's actually a pretty insane pitch that you can develop tissue for these brain drug development companies. And it's going to be light years ahead, and then they don't have to do, or they can be prepared for clinical trials and you can sell them that tissue. I think that's a great pitch. I don't know.
Yeah. To me, it's, you know, it's not the goal, but if it's a necessary
stepping stone, yeah,
step to get there, yeah, I'm happy to do that. And that's sort of what we're, the road we're taking.
That's the road you're taking. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Was there anything else that you think I should have asked you? Like, no. I don't know, you know, I could ask the questions about like what inspired you or I don't know, but
that's an easy answer.
You just want to live forever.
Yeah. Not dying. Not having people. I love dying and even anybody else, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was the quote at the end of your book? It was, if we love life, we should live it longer or so. What was it?
Yeah, it's something like that. If we love life, we should have the freedom to live it as long as we want, or something like that.
I wrote it down and it didn't save, but yeah, exactly. It was, if we truly love life, we should have the freedom to live.
Thanks for buying my book.
Yeah, it was a good book. I think I actually read it a long time ago, and then I saw your lectures the other day, and I reached out to you then. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I think we covered it all. I think this is really cool.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Yeah. I'm nervous to replace my brain, but like, you know, if it's the way to go, then
yeah, I'm a little bit nervous about replacing my brain over time, but I'm much more apprehensive about what happens if I don't.
Yes. Yes. Actually,
it's
so this
pretty
is,
clear. It's pretty guaranteed what's going to happen if you don't do that.
Yeah. So actually, I know this is a common question, but I figure I should ask it. Instead of just like getting our brain back to normal function, can we go beyond that?
Oh yeah.
I know that's a question that everybody asks you, but I figure we should address it.
I mean, in the future, it might be possible, but we'll have to know how it works and how it could potentially be optimized for our purposes. And right now we don't know that. And, you know, the beauty of the approach that we're taking is we don't have to understand how the brain develops. It did it on its own. It wasn't engineered, right? The cells did it on their own, mm-hmm. right? This brain tissue when we were fetuses and infants. And that's because the cells know what to do. They have this inherent program that they follow. And so we don't have to understand that much. We just have to recreate an environment that they can do this in the adult. And so our task is not as hard as like enhancing. I think you'll have to actually understand how it works, like the brain.
You can't just add tissue and be like, okay, let's see what yeah. happens.
No, you can't just add tissue. I think it's how it gets connected. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, you know, I have to ask that question. Sure, of course. Sure. Okay, one, cool. Well, okay. Sorry, go ahead.
One day we'll be able to, and it, you know, brain machine interfaces as well, I think are super cool. And eventually I hope they get to the point where it's not a one-way road. Like right now, the machine part of the brain machine interface is getting very good at reading the brain and what the brain's intentions are. But the other way around is not being developed much. You know, you can stick electrodes in the brain, but it's very primitive. So if that, you know, if that gets more sophisticated, then there's possible enhancements from that type of.
Are you excited for Neuralink?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I like what they're doing a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you get one?
Yeah, I mean, if I broke my neck and became a quadriplegic, yeah.
I mean, but you wouldn't get one just to like enhance yourself if you were normally functioning.
I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily be first in line for that. You know. Without long-term side effects, like, you know, a problem with a lot of electrodes. So there are people around now that have electrodes in their brain for different reasons, deep brain stimulation to treat Parkinson's for one, but they're testing it for other diseases as well. The problem is that over time, scar tissue builds around those electrodes. And I know Neuralink has come up with these fabulous, you know, single carbon fiber electrodes, which that may not happen, but I wouldn't want to be the first one to beta test it just for enhancement purposes.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat. Like people are like a similar question is, would you go to Mars? And I'm like, I would not want to be the first person there. Maybe in the future.
What is it? Yeah, exactly. I think for me to go to Mars, I think I want to have solved the longevity problem first, because the time it takes to get there, well, spend a little time there. It's like,
you can't waste 2 years traveling to Mars. Maybe like the moon is a little bit better.
Yeah.
I'd definitely go to the moon before I go to Mars. Okay. Anyways. Yeah. This was a great conversation. Thank you for the time. I really appreciate it. Where should people go follow you? And if they want to help your research or work for your lab or do something like that.
I think that best is go to lab website and I can, you know, send you that or just post.
Yeah, I'll put it in the description.
A chat. Yeah.
Yeah. It's herbertlab.einsteinmedneuroscience.org.
Yeah. Hebert Lab. So there's no R before the B.
Hebert. Yeah.
Yeah. So they'll be able to find links to other endeavors we're doing there as well.
And then your Twitter is replacing_aging.
Yeah.
Awesome. And go follow us. Okay, cool. Thank you for the time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jack.